Welcome to Step Into Magic, your weekly online radio show on how to develop your psychic ability with acclaimed medical intuitive, Josephine Lang. This broadcast is a part of the Wisdom and Intuition Network at metaphysicalwisdom.com. This is Anthony Taylor, your host, and on behalf of Josephine, I'll be taking your calls and questions. For those of you who are new to our show, Josephine has been a clairvoyant healer for more than 25 years. During that time, she's helped thousands of people from around the world to heal from hard-to-diagnose and chronic health issues. She has also been a teacher and spiritual mentor for hundreds of people who treasure her insights, courage, and love.
Hello, everyone. I hope that you all enjoyed the homework last week that we gave on daydreaming and on receiving messages to your questions about your life while spending time out in nature. So tonight, we'll be talking about the inner journey, myths, archetypes, and the dream of the self. You know, deep within us, we know the life that we're meant to live. And when we pay attention, our love and our joy will unerringly lead us to it. Working with myths and archetypes further helps us to uncover our unique path. And a part of this inner journey includes the fears, the distractions, and the temptations that arise. And they can sway us from our course, all right, but they also help us to fine-tune our focus on where it is that we really need to go. And as we overcome these obstacles, we learn how to follow our inner knowing. And then we're really able to fully rise to the dream of bringing into the world the one thing that only we can bring. But before I go into this topic any further, I always like to begin our show with a spiritual agreement. And this was a gift to me from my mentor and friend, Jana Massey. And she urged us all to share this agreement with each other in our relationships in life. I think it's a beautiful agreement, and I ask you all to make it with me, if you will. And it goes like this. Together, we acknowledge that everything that we think and that we say and that we do at this time will be of the highest good. And together we ask for truth, the understanding of that truth, and the wisdom to use it in our lives. Can you all agree?
I do.
Great, Tony. Thank you. And thank you all so much for agreeing with me on that.
Josephine, we had a couple of emails that came in after last week's show, and they are so nice that I simply have to read them out. The first is from a listener in California, and he writes, "Dear Josephine, I really did get deeply involved emotionally in your stories. They are a wonderful aid to your messages. Past emotions from my own childhood adventures were awakened, and I feel sure that your other listeners are also informed, entertained, and enlightened by all of your stories. They contribute enormously to revealing and enhancing your teaching."
Aww.
Very nice, isn't it? He also had a message for Frank. "Your beautiful slides bring nature into the show."
Oh, that's nice. Great.
And we had a second message from Anna Marie, who wrote, "Absolutely great show."
Oh, thank you guys so much. That's wonderful. And thank you, Tony, for sharing them. And it's always so nice to have messages like these. You know, we all need encouragement, and I'm no exception. And I really appreciate knowing how much you're all enjoying the show. Well, with that, Tony, perhaps you could show our next slide.
Certainly.
Which pretty much says it all, as Rumi often does. And Rumi says, "Let yourself be silently drawn by the stronger pull of what you really love." Isn't that great?
Mm.
I just love that one. That's one that I have on my wall in my healing room because it's so important. And this is the essence of what we're discussing tonight. We have to go where we're called. You know, Joseph Campbell said, "Follow your bliss." And I like to say, "Stay in your joy." And Peace Pilgrim said, you know, "Finding your calling," referring to that which calls to us. And that's what Rumi's talking about, that stronger pull of what you really love. And Peace also knows how we can get started on this journey if we really don't have an idea how in the world to begin to find our purpose. One of the things that she recommended, and I love this so much, she would say, and well, with that, perhaps you can show the next slide, Tony, please.
I'd love to.
Great. So she says, "Do all of the good things you are motivated to do, even if they are only little good things. Give these first priority in your life over all of the ordinary and mundane things that customarily clutter our human lives. And I think the real key here is that you are motivated to do. It's not just to do good, just to do good. It's to do the good things that you really want to do, that you have a calling to do, that you have a desire to do, that it would help you to find your bliss or your joy to do. That's where our motivation lies. And then she says to give these first priority. And I know for me in my life, that's always been the hardest part, because I was taught to, you know, get all of my work done first or whatever. And so often I'll find myself, you know, getting a little bit grumpy because I'm still working on something and I really want to go do something that I really want to do. And I want to give that first priority in my life, but often I won't let myself. Some sort of early childhood programming, perhaps, about needing to get my work done first, whatever that might be. And truly, you know, when we are in our bliss, our work is our joy, and we love it. And often that's what I'm yearning to get to, is my work for my, you know, my book or whatever it is. So we do want to give that first priority in our lives. It's a good thing to do.
Josephine, that sounds so simple. You know, do the thing that you most love. So why is it that so many of us struggle to stay on the path?
Well, you know, our modern society really encourages what I call surface living. Rarely does it ask us to reach down into what is really real. So we're constantly bombarded with advertising. I don't know what the figures are, but I know that they're enormous, how many ads we see every year or every day. And children especially see lots and lots of advertising. And this is constantly persuading us towards a false sense of ourself. And, you know, a lot of times indulgences, oh, like, you know, go for that Big Mac or not whatever, you know, go for that double cheeseburger or whatever, you know. Those can parade falsely as fulfillment. And that's not really what's going to fulfill us, or, you know, some other advertising thing that there might be, you know, a fancy car or whatever it is. That says, here, take this. This will fulfill you. But it's not necessarily the case. These indulgences don't necessarily fulfill us. They more like they delay our fulfillment. And there are illusions of gratification that lure us away from our true self.
So some part of us is getting something out of it, but it's just not, you know, the deeper us.
That's right. And then there's lots of various options that are distractions that promise to free us from boredom. And, you know, we can free ourselves from boredom by just shaking the reins loose and letting ourselves do what we'd love to do. And then another thing about advertising is that so often we're given the answers to what we want without ever having asked the question ourselves, what do I want?
Mm-hmm.
And so the answers are constantly getting given to us without us ever asking. And that's something to be aware of, too. And meanwhile, you know, there goes our precious life. It just slips away day by day. So, and then if we do wake up to what we'd really love in our lives, we risk falling back asleep because there's so much of the culture is sort of lulling us into that false sense of satisfaction or fulfillment or whatever. And it's hard, but we do need to really find, well, it's not always hard, it can be sometimes very easy, but we do need to find our own shimmering light, the one that belongs to us alone, which we can then use to help light the path for others. And, you know, In high school I studied some modern dance, and the teacher that I had, Mrs. Goldman, was a wonderful influence in my life. She was one of those people who really, you know, a transformative individual, and bless her spirit wherever she is today. And she shared with us in 1973 this wonderful quote by Martha Graham, the very popular modern dancer. And the quote has similarly become quite popular now, but it bears repeating because it's such a good one. And so maybe you could show that next slide for us, Tony.
Certainly, I'd love to.
This is a great, and I really am grateful to Frank this week because a lot of the slides this week have quite a lot of text, and he managed to fit them all on. That's really wonderful. So this slide says, and this is Martha Graham's quote, "There is a vitality, a life force, an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all time, this expression is unique. And if you block it, it will never exist through any other medium and be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, to keep the channel open. That's Martha Graham.
Yeah, it's very inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah, and our dance teacher used that to, you know, really encourage us as dancers to come forward with our own movement expression. And, you know, I'm still dancing to this day some 40 years later. Well, maybe it's not that long, but, well, yeah, actually it is, actually, I think. But, you know, she really opened me up, my friend and teacher, Mrs. Goldman. And part of it was, you know, just this energy of this quote that she had, to help us really find our own way in life, whatever it is. And dancing is definitely a part of my purpose.
Well, Josephine, I do have a question that I really want to ask you about that, just
yeah,
for me.
Please.
But before, we've received a message from Carl from Geelong in Australia.
Oh, lovely, Carl.
And he writes as follows. Hi, Josephine and Tony. Thanks for a great set of shows on finding our true purpose by following a path of joy. As far as deciding the right path to take, when I take a step in the direction of my true purpose, I will feel this big increase in physical energy and strength, and that tells me that, yes, this is the right path. It's the inspirational energy that one feels when you stay up all night talking with a good friend or lover. You are literally in spirit. Usually the choice is dogged by fear and self-doubt, by your critical censor, but this is a good thing because it means that you are pushing the boundaries and traveling from the known into the unknown.
Wow.
Finally, once I take the creative leap, everything falls naturally into place and the universe rewards me for taking a risk on its behalf. It's true, spine-tingling, heart-throbbing, creative risk, but we will never know who we really are unless we make that first step from the known to the unknown and that creative vision become provision. So jump, Carl.
Wow, that is so great.
What a message.
That was wonderful. Carl, thank you so much for writing that in. And you really have the true measure of what I'm trying to express. And you did it so beautifully. That was just great.
Fantastic.
From vision to provision.
I love that.
Yes, and dogged by doubt. And that does happen to us. But, you know, we really can go, we do have to go from the known into the unknown. We have to take that leap, that risk, and it is spine tingling. It can be chilling, but that's really the essence of it, and that is how we are provided for. You know, I'd like to, I often think of Aretha Franklin. I mean, well, yes, Aretha Franklin and also Georgia O'Keeffe. You know, Georgia O'Keeffe, what I loved about her and her pursuit of her art was that she, you know, basically secluded herself, and she didn't really receive visitors. She was not the sort to sit and, you know, have friends by for tea. In fact, she discouraged it because she had such a passion for her art, and she had to create, and she had to take long walks out into the desert near her home and get inspired and see the colors and move the you know, images around on the canvases. And she was the kind of person who, you know, just said no to those distractions and those outer influences. And Aretha Franklin, I think of her because of that wonderful lyric that she has in that one song where she says, "Girl, I ain't got time to sit and chit-chat and smile." And to me, that's such a profound lyric because really sometimes, you know, our lives can sort of get distracted away, and we do need to stay on track with ourselves and with our lives. And sometimes we do need to learn how to say no, like both Georgia O'Keeffe and Aretha Franklin did in these two examples. And for my own part, when I was busy, you know, recovering from one of my injuries, I did a lot of volunteerism because that was something that I could do. And volunteers, you know, they don't have to show up on a given day. They can come when they can. And so that was a really wonderful thing. But when my purpose really started to call me in another direction and I had to stop my volunteerism, that was a tricky time because I had been so culturally conditioned to always say yes. As a young woman, you know, that's the archetype of the young woman. Say, oh, yes, of course, you know, pleasing and trying to do what is right all the time and innocent and helpful and all of that. And so I was trying to meet with and stay with that archetype, but at the same time I was being pulled in this other direction to really go within and really take the time to discover and find myself. And so I had to learn how to say no. And it was hard at first. And so I actually made myself a little cue card that is still on the bottom of my telephone to this day, just to remind me that sometimes we do have to say no. And what I said on that cue card was, and I'm quoting here, I've got a lot of things going on right now. So that was one thing I could say. Or I could say, what did you have in mind? You know, instead of just immediately saying, oh, yes, you know, because so often in our culture we say yes, and then our stomach goes into these contractions as we're thinking, oh, my God, I can't do that.
Well, I think, Josephine, that might be a particularly Californian thing to always say yes.
It could be a particularly Californian thing, but in any case, it had me pretty severely. And another one that's on my cue card is, I can't commit just at the moment. And then the fourth one was, let me get back to you on this. And all of these were options that I could use that would give me a little time to process and find an appropriate loving kindness way to come up with the words to decline or to give myself time to check within to see if I really could. And it was a really, really big learning for me, something that I really had to do. And the teachers who were the energy that my dear friend and mentor, Jana Massey, channeled, had a wonderful piece of advice that they gave. And Frank, put that on a slide as well. And perhaps you could show that slide, Tony, if you would.
Certainly.
And this slide says, only that which is mine to do, no more, no less. And that has really been a guiding influence for me. And it was really what helped me to make that transition between my time that I spent volunteering for very worthwhile and wonderful causes, but making that transition into my own true purpose, which was more closely aligned with my soul work and my soul growth. And so I love that little phrase, only that which is mine to do, no more, no less. It really helped to ground and center me on my own path and my own journey. And maybe you all have a similar sort of an experience or a similar phrase that you can use that can help you to stay true to your true path. So I really welcome that for you in whatever way it shows up.
That's really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Although lately I think my issues have been more to do with me and not other people. I have been very busy imposing things on me, but we'll get to that later. You were telling us about the importance of staying true to ourselves and on track with our purpose. As I was saying, what if the problem is not others but ourself? What if we keep creating our own distractions? What do we do then?
Oh, I know that one well.
Well, that's happening to me a lot at the moment because I was incredibly busy for so long, and now it's kind of like it's eased off a bit.
Good.
And I was thinking, oh, I'll get back to do a couple of things that I really wanted to do, and I'm not doing them. I'm kind of like doing other things or wasting time, or I don't know what I'm doing. But in those bits of time that I do get, I'm not really, I feel like I'm not staying on track. I'm not on the path.
Well, you know, sometimes I like to look at that as just sort of letting ourselves sit on the back burner and simmer a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we just have to let the computer run for a little while to download some information.
Okay.
You know, so that can be it too. But also there is also the element of procrastination that can come in. And I used to be a major procrastinator, but I'm not so much anymore.
Okay. Well, I think I am a little bit in that camp at the moment. So that would be really useful.
Well, I find that procrastination is generally either of two things, either fear of success or fear of failure. And we'll address the fear of failure one first, because that one seems to be...
I think I have both.
Yeah, and it can be both at the same time.
Sure, I've got both.
You know, Robert Bly wrote a wonderful book that's called A Little Book on the Human Shadow. Fabulous read. It's HarperCollins, I think. And so A Little Book on the Human Shadow. I highly recommend it. It's great. And in it, he talks about the shame pot, that we all have a pot that we drag along behind us that is full of our shame. And sometimes it gets so full that it just can't hold one more little bit of shame. And we, you know, have a kind of a little mini hissy fit or an attack. No, get away. And sometimes that can happen to us when we're moving through life. And then as well, there is shame resilience. There are people who can be quite resilient with shame. They just don't let it fill up in their pot. They just have a way of moving through it and moving beyond it. And Renee Brown, in her wonderful little book, The Gifts of Imperfection, her subtitle is, Let Go of Who You Think You're Supposed to Be and Embrace Who You Are, which I think is really great.
Mm.
And her book has won quite a number of awards, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was on a PBS special, and it's a lovely, lovely book. And what happens to us when we have guilt, let's say, as opposed to shame, is guilt is more like I did something bad, and then we can, you know, apologize and make amends and change things. And it can really be a motivator for positive change. Now, I'm not much of a guilt person. I don't do too much guilt or shame, thank goodness. I just somehow manage to breeze through in my personality. And that's not to say that that couldn't change, but fortunately, knock on a little wood, I feel pretty good about that. But shame, the distinction with that is not that I did something bad, it's that I am bad. And that is something that we are culturally taught sometimes, that, you know, that born in sin or whatever, there's all sorts of imagery that comes through for that. And that can be a really self-destructive type energy in our lives. Shame can really create for us self-loathing and self-doubt. And shame also corrodes our belief, the belief in ourselves that we can do better. So with guilt, we think, well, I can do better. With shame, we think, oh, there's no way, I'm horrible. And the way that we correct self-loathing is we learn how to love ourselves. And I really find that self-love is the foundation. And that's why I always begin all of my teachings with self-love. And, of course, the current-day goddess of self-love is Louise Hay with her book, You Can Heal Your Life. And she had, you know, tremendous shaming experiences as a young person and managed to crawl up out of that by that one wonderful phrase, you know, our thoughts control our life, and the only thing that we need to control is our thoughts. And we can control our thoughts, and that's where shame can really get us when we're not shame resilient, is our thoughts. We let our thoughts spiral us down into that I am bad thing, as opposed to people who are more shame resilient, who know how to catch themselves and think, you know, it's okay, it happened, and everybody has shame, and it's all right, and, you know, how much do you want to hold on to this, or do you want to just let it go? And making different choices. So anyway, that's a wonderful book that I recommend for if you are the kind of person who does have some troubles with shame. The Gifts of Imperfection is great, Brené Brown, and then also Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life. Couple of great books on that. And then just the little book on the human shadow, you know, owning up to what is real in our lives. Great, great steps for how to move beyond that fear of failure thing that can be at the root of our procrastination. And then also, if you'd like, I have 10 steps to self-love that I'm happy to send anybody if they just want to go ahead and email me at my website there. And what self-love does for us is it really helps us to open to and to awaken to what I call the great triple blessing in our lives. And that's that our spirituality and our psychic ability and our purpose, those three, are all intertwined. That's the great triple blessing. And if we work on one, the other two miraculously come along. We develop the other two as well. And as we work on our self-love and we gain in our spirituality and our psychic ability and our purpose, we step into a self-actualized life, to what would be considered a really authentic life. And people who live in an authentic way, they tend to be more shame resilient. So that's what I would recommend for you, Tony, as well as all of our listeners and anybody out there who has some problems in this aspect of their lives.
Start with the self-love.
Start with the self-love. That is the foundation. And then on top of that, we can, you know, build the cornerstones which bring us around, which are dreams, dream interpretation, meditation, prayer, and sanctuary. And those practices will bring us up to that wonderful triple blessing of developing our spirituality and our psychic ability and our purpose, so that we can create the home of our life that is a self-actualized or an authentic life. Yeah, so just write me if you'd like a copy of the 10 Steps to Self-Love. It's a great way to get started.
Well, I have a copy of that here.
Good.
So I'm obviously not following it enough.
Yeah.
I need to get out of bed in the morning and go into the bathroom and look at myself and say I love you. That's hard because there's almost always someone in the bathroom when I get up in the morning.
Well, you might need to get yourself a little hand mirror.
I'm gonna
flip it between the mattress and the box spring.
I'm gonna have to whip it
out when you have a moment. Or look in the mirror, rearview mirror of the car after you drop everybody off at work and at school, and take a moment and and just love yourself, because that is one of the steps, is the mirror work, which is what Louise Hay advises and what I did to bring myself out, because I had these same problems too when I was first beginning the journey. I think we all have a certain amount of self-loathing. It's just kind of part of our cultural programming, and learning how to step into that self-love is a wonderful thing. There are a few children on the planet, and I've heard of them, who have been raised to understand that their parents knew that they were geniuses and just raised them with that in mind. And what a beautiful thing that is when that happens. And then those children are not so full of ego as much as they are full of self-love and lack of self-doubt. They trust themselves, and that's a wonderful, beautiful thing.
Mm.
So we can change the way that we parent, and there are some wonderful people who are beginning to do work on children's rights and things who are helping us to understand that we want to teach our children to love themselves and to appreciate who they are and their unique expression in the world. So the other side of it, you know, not only do we have fear of failure, but we also have fear of success. And this is, I've got another very famous quote for you that perhaps you can show the next slide there, Tony. This is by Marianne Williamson from her book, A Return to Love. It sometimes has been attributed to Nelson Mandela in the past, but it's Marianne who wrote this. And it's very beautiful. I love this particular quote. And I'll read it out. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. That's Marianne Williamson. I'll read that first line again because that will help you to identify it if you need to look for it on the internet or something. The first line is, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Isn't that beautiful?
Yes, and I'm sure that relates to me as well. But meanwhile, we've had a question that's come in from Charles.
Good.
From Florida, and he asks, what role do the myths and archetypes play in all of this?
Oh, well, thank you, Charles, very much. I'm so glad you asked that, because that's right where I was wanting to go. So, you know, myths, they're very numerous. There's lots of creation myths, the world round. There's all sorts of myths that are abundant in the many cultures of the world. And, of course, probably here in the West, we're most familiar with the Greek myths, the gods and goddesses like Artemis, who protects young animals and the innocent, or Hestia, who stands by the hearth and keeps the fire burning, or Zeus, the lightning rod god of discipline. And then there's, of course, the Roman counterparts like Jupiter and Diana and Vesta. And then as well, we have, beyond the myths and the stories that come with the myths, we also have archetypes. And archetypes are sort of energies that come with images, like being a queen or a princess, you know, even like that old TV show from the 50s, Queen for a Day, or isn't she a beautiful little princess, you know, in our families we speak like that, or the magician, or the jokester, or the trickster, or coyote, or the great mother, or the lover, or the spy, or the teacher. All of these archetypes are kind of like these big energies that are held around those images. And we sometimes get labeled these in families, and we sometimes think of them ourselves, think of ourselves in terms of those archetypes. And we enter into the river, I like to call it the river of these archetypes and these myths. And they are like dreams of the self. They're like how we think of ourselves. And we might see ourselves as these archetypes, or others might see us that way, and it can influence us. Because each archetype carries with it the energetic weight of all the many people who have come before us or who are in that same archetype with us now. And collectively, that's quite a combined energetic force. It's like a mighty river flowing along, carrying us in its current. and we can get swept away by it. And also, you know, we can meet these various archetypes in our nighttime dreams, especially if we're studying myths and archetypes. I was thinking the other day of a dream of running down a hill with some friends, and the friends all hopped on horses and rode away, and I jumped on a tiger and rode the tiger. And, you know, I've recently heard a parable. I think it was Rob Bresny's astrology for Leo, and he talked about how, you know, there's a time, this is taught by an Indian sage, there's a time where you're in the cage and you're safe and the tiger is outside. And then there comes a time where you're outside and the tiger is in the cage and you're safe. And then there comes the time where you're riding the tiger, where you're one with that deep mythical part of yourself. And, you know, a tiger is different from a lion. A lion is sort of, you know, King Richard the Lionhearted. You know, there's a lot of energy there. But tiger can be more the man-eater. For some people might think of a tiger that way. I don't think so much along the lines of a man-eater, but I think of it as that which has a lot of personal power and can really move in the sort of shadowy aspects of the world. And as a psychic, of course, that's what I do. And so, you know, it's not so right on the surface like the conscious mind. It's coming out of the subconscious a little bit. So to me, that was kind of an interesting thing, that because usually I'm associated with the horse in my dreams, but to be associated with the tiger was a little bit of a different switch on it. And I'm sure that there have been many people who have had similar dreams like that. Perhaps you can think of one yourselves out there listening, of something where you've had a dream where an archetypal image has come in, something like a tiger or a mother or a jokester or a trickster or coyote, and has sort of carried you away. Or even the Beatles, you know, they're archetypes in a way too. I have had some friends who've had dreams with, you know, George Harrison in it or something like that. It's wonderful images that we have that. And so we can take a look at these images and we can use them to guide us, if it feels right, when we're doing our own dream interpretations. So we can move towards that energy or we can move away from it. Let's say that maybe the image in a dream was not really the kind of energy that we'd like, so then that can be a warning to us to move away from it. And we just want to be aware and to see if and how we want these archetypes or these images or these myths to affect us, because they will affect us if we let them. And that can lend either helpful energy to our venture, or it can limit us by holding us to an energy or a pattern that might not be quite right for the right fit for us. So just to pay attention to that and just to be aware of it, because by the sheer weight of numbers, you know, like for instance, when I enter into the archetype of the teacher, which I do from time to time, how many teachers are there in the world? Jillions of them. So, you know, that's a very strong, powerful river that I enter into when I'm in my teaching mode. And I can use that to help me, but I also sometimes want to step out of that river and go more into that, maybe into that riding the tiger zone where I'm off on my own in the dark and finding my way. Tigers have excellent night vision, and they also swim, so they get into the water of the emotions there. So being aware, and, you know, only that which is mine to do.
Thank you, Josephine. Oh, I love mythology. It's always struck me as a shame that these days people seem so unaware of, you know, the mythologies, whether it's Greek or Egyptian or, I don't know, Roman or Irish, Celtic, Scandinavian, whatever. For me, they're so rich. And
yeah.
All of those ancient pagan cultures had complex mythologies. And it seems when you study them that they share lots of things in common. And you seem to get the same version of a myth occurring in a slightly different form over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that they sort of conveying universal human traits about who we are. And I know that they're recognized in Jungian psychology. We were talking about that before with the Red Book and the exhibition down in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
And I know in Jungian psychology they make use of the archetypes in their therapy. And the archetypes can help people to recognize the behaviors which seem peculiar to them are actually universal. And sometimes they can help a person to see that their life has become dominated by a particular archetype. For example, the grumpy old man, sometimes referred to as the Cynex. The man who's been there and done that, and he's a bit Saturnian, he's a dark quality. And then the opposite to that, the antidote, is something sometimes called the puer aeternus, the boy forever, the eternal child. This is Peter Pan, who never wants to grow up. And these archetypes are often found side by side. So in relationships or in families or possibly even in the same person. So you tend to find that if the father is all Cenex, then the son may become inclined to become all Pu'e, all Peter Pan. And so sometimes we need to recognize how we've been dominated by an archetype in order to free ourselves from it.
Yes, that's very, very true. And thank you for that. They can really guide us, you know, like I was saying, or they can pull us along, and that most definitely can influence us.
All right then, Josephine. So if we do recognize then that we're being pulled along by an archetype or a myth, and I know this from my own experience that that's happened, I can see that this archetype is playing out. What do you recommend then? How do we free ourselves?
Well, I have two things that I'd like to recommend for everybody to do this week if you get some time, which would be to just, you know, take a little time to think of any mythic ideas or archetypal energies that may be playing a part in your life and see how it feels. You know, is this a benefit? Is it a good fit for you, or is it kind of pulling at you? Is there some sort of feelings of obligation or kind of getting lost in it? So that's the first thing, to just sort of take a little bit of time sometime this week, if you will, and just sort of get a feel for how archetypes are influencing in your life. And then also, I'd like to share a little exercise, and this is a sound healing exercise.
Oh, good. Looking forward to that.
And this was taught to me by, once again, by my beautiful, wonderful friend and mentor, Jana Massey. She was a sound healer as well as a person who brought messages from spirit, a trans channel. And the sound is what she brought, and I have a little exercise that can kind of accompany it. So we'll do that right now. So if you'd like, and if you're not, of course, operating machinery, like say if you're driving the car, wait and do this later. But just take a couple of relaxed and easy breaths and think back over your day today. So we are all telepathic. Just remember what happened during the day today. Take a moment. What did you do first thing in the morning, and midday, and later in the afternoon, coming towards evening? And then realizing that we're all telepathic, we often receive the thoughts of others. Not only do we receive them, but we also give them. When we think of somebody else, that's a thought form, an energetic thought form that goes out to that other person. And can you remember a time today when there is a thought that you might have had that might not have been your own? It may have come from someone else, probably someone who you know and love, and someone who loves you. Maybe there's an image associated with the thought. And perhaps somebody thought of you archetypically. Maybe they see you as being a teacher or think you should be a mother. Or maybe you have a thought about yourself. Maybe you see yourself sabotaging yourself. That is another one of the archetypes, you know, the saboteur. No matter. Just realize that these thoughts can enter into our own sphere of awareness all the time, and that we can also send them to others. And when we receive them telepathically from another source, we can either accept them, or we can let them go, as we choose. That's what we do with all telepathic messages. We either accept them or we let them go. And we humans are learning right now in this time in our human evolvement how to wake up to our telepathy a little more, how to understand that it's going on all the time. It's our natural way, actually. Animals all communicate by telepathy. I have fun sometimes watching my cats telepathically communicate to my dog. My dog telepathically communicate back to the cats. They have a wonderful relationship together. So these thoughts and archetypal images, they tend to collect in what is known as the psychic collar. And this is an energetic collar. It's from about the level of your chin to your like from your chin and your ear around the back of your head down to about your clavicle. A little zippy tune there.
Yes, that was me. Apologies for that.
That's quite all right. So I was just describing the psychic collar. It extends from the chin to the ear and then down to about the clavicle or the shoulder level. And so to the front of the body, it's at the clavicle, and to the back, it just goes around about the upper back up there. And it's energetic in nature. It's kind of like an energetic donut around our neck there. And so if you can just imagine that psychic collar there, then know that every time we get into a shower, we clean our psychic collar. It gets rinsed clean. But we can also clean at any time of the day or the night by simply making the sound of the bumblebee. So if you put your upper and lower front teeth together very lightly, just barely touching, and make the Z sound, last letter of the alphabet, let a little vibration arise. And let's just do this together now three times, each with a breath. Now just notice, you may notice a slight freedom that has just occurred. I've been doing this exercise for many years, so I can tell right away.
I definitely feel something, yeah.
Isn't that nice? It's a lightening.
It's a lightening.
Yeah, so just know that any thoughts or images that are not yours will have simply dissolved. And this Z sound, when it's issued with intention, will completely clear your psychic collar. Isn't that a lovely little exercise?
It's lovely, yes.
So that's something that we can all do whenever we feel a little too much pressure from the archetypes or from the myths or from other people's thoughts or, you know, any even of our own thoughts that we have sort of lingering there.
Or telephone calls coming in at the wrong time.
It'll clear those too.
Good.
No, I'm just teasing. So now I'd like to get into a little bit of Joseph Campbell's beautiful teachings. You know, I'm sure very many of you are familiar with the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell talks about. And I'd like to just go through that a little step-to-step manner. So basically what happens in the hero's journey, and I loved that, you know, the Luke Skywalker character in the Star Wars film that George Lucas produced. George Lucas got together with Joseph Campbell to talk about the hero's journey to help formulate his movie, Star Wars, according to that journey, because it is so mythic. It really carries such a strong influence in all of our lives to have these kinds of experiences. And though not all of us have that kind of heroic life, sometimes our lives can be, and our purposeful lives can be very simple, like that one we described a couple of weeks ago with Peace Pilgrim. You know, the woman who played the piano at the old folks' home for her joy and for her exercise she swam and for her livelihood she did flower arranging. That's a wonderful, simple, beautiful life of purpose, and not one that's, you know, terribly dramatic and heroic, but still a beautiful life. But this is more along the lines, this story, The Hero's Journey, is more along those kind of purposeful lives that really do involve some big energy. And so typically what happens in The Hero's Journey is the person is leading a rather day-to-day sort of ordinary life, ordinary type life, and then there's some sort of wake-up call or a calling. And in the case of Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, there was that attack on the village and his parents were killed. And he was called to go out and to defend and to fight. And so this wake-up call happens, or this calling occurs that separates you from other people. And perhaps you all can think about how this may have happened to you, because it's remarkably common, this hero's journey. Even in our everyday lives, we don't necessarily think of ourselves as heroes, but often there is some sort of hero quality to a life. And in my own case, for me, you know, day-to-day life, I was a gardener. And then I had this injury pattern that came on, three big injuries, one after another, that lasted, the healing of which lasted for over a decade and required me to spend, on two separate occasions, almost a year in bed that was a complete wake-up call. That was something that really separated me from others. It took me away from my usual circle of friends, and with each of the three injuries, cultivated a new circle of friends. So that after healing from the back injury, the first one, the circle of friends became those volunteers that I was doing good work with. And then after the knee injury, the circle of friends became a little bit more of a spiritually focused. And then after the head injury, moving right into the psychic ability, medical intuitive circles. And that was a wonderful experience for me, but it was hard and it was difficult at the time to lose those circles of friends and find myself moving and shifting so quickly. It was quite uncomfortable, as can be the case with these wake-up calls or these things that separate ourselves from the rest of the group. And then as well, during that time, my empathy, starting early on, my physical empathy began to come on very strongly. So I began to feel the physical symptoms that other people were experiencing in their bodies, in my body. Talk about telepathy. It was like if they were feeling pain, I was a human sponge walking around and I would feel whatever they were feeling. So if I would stand in line in the grocery store next to somebody who had a splitting headache, suddenly my head would start to hurt. And so I'd change lines, and then there I'd be feeling something like kidney pain or something in my low back. I'd change lines again. Oh, this one's not so bad. I'll stand here.
This sounds awful.
It was awful. It was a really difficult thing. I didn't know how to manage it. It wasn't until I started to use my empathy in a productive way, working with Dr. Otto in the, you know, healing confines of his office in the private with him, you know, just working, helping him with his patients and with my own healing and his healing and his family's healing and some of his patients at the early part and then more patients later on, that as I began to use my empathy, then it no longer just invaded me like that. It was put to rightful purpose, and so I didn't have to just experience it willy-nilly. And there's often a reluctance that comes with this wake-up call or calling. And believe me, early on with that empathy in my life, there was a great deal of reluctance. It was, you know, something I just didn't know what to do about or how to handle it. It was before Carolyn Mace began her lecture tour and coined the term medical intuitive. And it was long after Edgar Cayce, who was the sleeping prophet who helped people with their health and healing. But he did it in a sleep state, he was a trance channel. So he would go into his office, lay down on the sofa, and take a little nap, and people would come in, and then a part of him would awaken and say, okay, you need to use a castor oil plaster on this part of your body, and perhaps some comfrey root poultice on this part, and maybe some healing herbal teas of various sorts. So these bits of information would come through Edgar Cayce while he was asleep. And that was in like the 40s and 50s, and here I was in the early 80s with this experience, and I just really didn't know what to do with it. And I had not ever read any of Edgar Cayce's work, and I didn't know what it was that I was experiencing, and it was frightening. And that's another symptom that can happen with the hero's journey. Not only is there the reluctance, but there's also fear often involved, as was the case with me, feeling the pain of others.
And Paul mentioned that as well in his email.
Yes, exactly. He did. Absolutely. Yeah. There can be that, you know, it's got that wonderful thrill of, yeah, let's stay up all night, but it's risky, and it can be scary to leave the known and go into the unknown. And it can, like you said, dogged by doubt. So, but the great thing is that when you do take that leap, like he said, you know, like Carl had mentioned, from vision to provision, you know, when we take that leap, doors will open for us, as Joseph Campbell said, where there would not even be a door for someone else. And that's what happened for me in the inner sanctum of Dr. Otto's office. You know, here I found this wonderful avenue where I could use this skill and have it be appreciated and have it be able to help others in their healing. And then as well, we also have to confront our fears when we go into this hero's journey. And I'm hoping that some of these things are ringing bells for some of you who are listening too, because like Carl said, you know, this is the journey. This is one of the journeys that we go through when we are on the hero's journey. We do have fears that we have to confront. For me, one of the big ones was crossing over. Sometimes after I would work on a person for Dr. Otto, just using their patient card, you know, I would come up with images and impressions of what was going on with their body and what needed to be addressed for their health and healing. And then sometimes after the office visit would be over, after he and I worked in private together, I would feel lingering symptoms that that person had. And I thought, oh, my God, did I catch this thing from them? You know, that was scary for me. Until I realized that really all it was that there was something that was already inside of me, a little tiny bud of that same problem, that when I did that work for the other person, it resonated within me, and I looked at it with a new eyes, as that which helped me to see what was already present in myself and allowed me to jump the gun on healing that myself so that I could go ahead and move into a healing modality for my own self to clear that out of my own body. And that, that crossing over was not a curse, as I had originally thought, but it was a blessing because it let me address something in a very early state. So there are these fears or these challenges that come. And this is like the slay the dragon time in the hero's journey. Another one was that until 2007, it wasn't really legal for people to act in a healing modality unless they were a part of the medical profession or were a chiropractor. And so I had to get my ministerial license. So I became a minister so that I could continue to do my healing work, even though I was doing it in secret and in private. And I was not receiving, you know, income from it at that time. So that was part of another thing that I had to, another dragon that I had to slay. And I also came up with a very detailed agreement form that I have everybody sign before I do my work so that I can be in compliance legally with our current existing system. So there are things that we have to overcome, these obstacles that are a part of this journey. And then when we do overcome those obstacles, ta-da, we claim the gold that the dragon is hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can bring that back to our culture, to our society. We're free to return to our home and share that which we have gained. And so and I'm sure that many of you who are listening today have had similar experiences in your life where you've had to go and accomplish some, you know, everybody has a story to tell. And when I walk down the street, sometimes I look at the faces of people and I think, my goodness, there's so much depth there. And we all have these kinds of hero's journeys within ourselves. If it's even, you know, saving the life of our child through a very difficult moment or in their youth, or helping a parent to overcome an obstacle, or a good friend to help pull them up out of a troubled spot, or to rise up ourselves out of the mire. All of it. It's all amazing. So our stories can really inspire others. They give us all hope, and they awaken in us all. They awaken us all to really new possibilities in our lives. When we accept these challenges and we rise up and claim our heart's desire, it's a wonderful life, and it's something that we really need to do. As Carl said, we move from vision to provision, and it is spine tingling. And with that, Tony, perhaps you can move on to our next slide. This is one of my all-time favorite quotes. I have this posted in my healing room as well. And this is a quote by Gandhi. And it goes like this. God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. And when a person thus loses themselves, that person immediately finds themselves in the service of all that lives. Such service becomes their delight and recreation. They become a new person, never weary of spending themselves in the service of God's creation. Isn't that beautiful?
That's a beautiful quote.
I just love it. And, you know, I'm going to just go through it again because it is so rich and it's so deep. So, you know, for me, God is genderless. There's no masculine or feminine. And to me, it's love. It's the essence of our universe. But God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender. I mean, that's what we have to do. We have to just give ourselves over to it. This is what Carl was talking about. When we jump from the known into the unknown, we really have to just give ourselves over. And that is the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. It's like we have to lose ourselves in order to find ourselves. And that's exactly what he says. When a person thus loses himself, that person immediately finds himself in the service of all that lives.
Mm.
And such service becomes their delight and recreation. In comes joy. And the same thing happened for me with Dr. Otto. Some of you who've heard this story before know that that was my absolute passion. It was the only thing I wanted to do. I would wait and wait for the phone to ring. Oh, he called. cold. I get to go in and work. I loved it. It just thrilled me no end. And that's the truth of it. When we are in this kind of a journey, we find that we love it more than anything else. And then that person becomes a new person, never weary of spending themselves in the service of God's creation. And that is so true, like Carl was saying. You stay up all night. You're in spirit. It's just an big increase in physical energy. It's so, so true. So thank you, Carl, again, for calling in with your beautiful message today.
Thank you so much for that, Josephine. Unfortunately, I see we are getting very near the end. So perhaps I should say that the link to next week's show can be found on Josephine's website. Simply go to stepintomagic.com and click on the radio. And if you've enjoyed the show, we really hope that you will tell your friends. We love when you're on the air with us and when you send us messages and when you call in with your questions and comments. So, if you've been tempted to make contact but haven't yet, please do. We'd love to hear from you. So, Josephine, are there any parting words that you'd like to say?
Yes, Tony, there are. And I love this quote by Howard Thurmond. And Frank made a final slide for us, so if you could please put it on, I'd be very grateful.
There it is.
And I'd like to close our show today with his words. So Howard Thurmond says, "Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, that's really inspiring.
I love it. And when we're in our joy, we are as alive as we can be. So remember, stay in your joy and let joy be your guide in life. There is no truer compass. It will take you right to where you need to go, past the dragons and right into the heart of your life. I really appreciate all of you taking the time to listen tonight. And in closing, I'd like to share this little blessing with you, which goes like this. As our gifts are given in love, they are received in love. And we honor their wise use and their increase for all concerned. And so it is.
Thank you so much for that, Josephine. As always, it's been a real pleasure talking with you this evening. And I trust that everyone listening has learned lots about the inner journey towards finding our true purpose. This has been show number PS-3.14. And we look forward to having all of you join us again next week when Josephine will be exploring various typologies and their role in helping us to discover our calling in life.
Tony and I wish you all insight, wisdom, and magic as you pursue the journey of inner knowing. I hold you all in light and in love. Thank you so much for listening. This is Josephine Lang. Until next week, good night.